All right. Got some beautiful intro music there by Kevin Elliott, none other than WEFT Zone Kevin Elliott, who hosts from the Joshua Tree Inn on Tuesday nights from 6 to 8 p.m. So you can catch him tomorrow for the best of folk music and folk bluegrass and all those regions in between, something like that. You're listening to WEFT 90.1 FM Champaign, Illinois, and streaming online at weft.org. Welcome to CU Progressive News, bringing you the many voices of your community. This show is produced live in the studios of WEFT 90.1 FM and at 113 North Market Street in beautiful, vibrant downtown Champaign, Illinois. This program is a collaborative effort. Please email weft90.1 at gmail.com with your program ideas to get information on or to be trained to be a citizen reporter or to be a WEFT host. The CU Progressive Calendar is a sister project of CU Progressive News, and it's available at tinyurl.com/CU Progressive. If you type in tinyurl.com/CU Progressive News, then you will actually see that's the YouTube channel for UPTV's stream of our show. CU Progressive News. We're indebted to WEFT and its members who currently and who have for 35 years provided the infrastructure for our independent media. We're indebted to the Public Eye, UCIMC, and UPTV for their collaboration as well. The views and opinions expressed on this program are solely those of the speakers and do not necessarily represent those of WEFT, Prairie Air Incorporated, the Urbana-Champaign Independent Media Center, Urbana Public TV, or any board of directors or staffs of those organizations. Let's see. What else here? The places and times that you can tune in to CU Progressive News include today, Monday, 6 to 7 p.m., live on WEFT. Tuesdays, it's added to the UPTV6 YouTube channel. Again, you can get that through tinyurl.com/CU Progressive News or go to UPTV6 is what you should search for on YouTube. Thursdays at 10 to 11 o'clock, it's replayed on UPTV. That's local cable channel 6. It's available by podcast 24/7 through iTunes, SoundCloud, or whatever your favorite podcatcher is. And it's also available as an audio archive at weft.org through Radio Free America, as are all of our programs, even the music programs. So there's a really interesting thing in that we can always put archives of our public affairs shows online and listen to them indefinitely. But that's not the case with music shows. You can't put them online and have people listening to them indefinitely because it would violate the royalties, something to do with royalties. But we can keep them up there for 2 weeks. So that's a service we've just started in the last several months here. Part of what we're doing for WEFT Vision 2020, which is to try to make a sustainable plan for WEFT for the next 5 years. If you're interested in WEFT, our board meeting is tonight at 7 p.m. at 44 East Main Street. Actually starts at 7:30 because 7 o'clock is a closed session tonight. But at 7:30, the open session starts, and there's a lot on the agenda to discuss how we are going to keep get the fall pledge drive up and running and how you listeners are going to be asked to support, as well as how we're going to get underwriting for our shows through businesses. So lots on the agenda, and we're hoping that you can be part of that. There's also ongoing volunteer training here, and all you have to do is email stationmanager@weft.org, and she can tell you how to, the person that answered that can tell you how to become involved with WEFT and go through our training. So what else do I want to tell you here before we get started? I want to tell you that our speaker, our guest tonight, we're going to be talking about the Olympics in Rio in 2016 with Neil Partham. Hello, Neil.
Hello.
Got some announcements before we get to our interview with you, but really glad to have Neil here. He is host of a program called Not Just Another Sports Show, I think I have it right, on WRFU, one of our sister stations. WRFU is a low-power radio station in Urbana, housed at the Independent Media Center and playing on 104.5. That's right. Yep. And he also has his show broadcast on UPTV also. Do you know what time your show is usually broadcast?
It has been Wednesdays most of the time. Mm-hmm. Wednesdays in the evening.
Yes, it's a very interesting look between sports and politics, basically, social justice issues, a lot of that. So I wanted to let you know before we get started, though, a news item that came across my desk, and that is that a new Illinois law that limits how police can use devices that cast a wide net in gathering cell phone data are at the center of a lawsuit against the Chicago Police Department. Governor Bruce Rauner signed the legislation into law on Friday and drew immediate praise from civil libertarians. This is according to the Associated Press. The new law requires police to delete the phone information of anyone who wasn't an investigative target within 24 hours. It also prohibits police from accessing data for use in an investigation not authorized by a judge. A dozen other states have adopted such regulations, and Congress is considering legislation that would strengthen federal guidelines already in place. Quote, cell site simulator technology, too powerful to remain unregulated, Kadeen Bennett says, who is an associate of legislative director for the American Civil Liberties Union of Illinois. She said in an emailed statement in which the group thanked the governor and the legislator for the new law. She says the federal government has adopted modest guidelines similar to those enacted today. If the restrictions are good enough for the FBI, they should be workable for the local law enforcement in Illinois. The Illinois State Police has taken a neutral position on the law, and the Chicago Police Department did not take a position. Chicago police are being sued by plaintiffs who are trying to force it to release records about how it uses this technology. Again, that technology is cell phone data and how police can use devices that cast a wide net in gathering cell phone data. So I don't know exactly what the devices are that gather that cell phone data.
Stingrays, they'd be able to be used to spoof a cell phone signal. So you'd think you'd actually be getting a cell phone signal from your cell provider, and you're actually getting a signal from their Stingray service.
Oh, really?
And they could be able to intercept your information that way.
So it's not just after the fact stuff. It's setting people up by making them think that they're getting cell phone signals through their carrier AT&T, but they're getting a cell phone signal.
It's very weird to hear the phrase Bruce Rauner in praise.
I know it is. You're right. It says that privacy advocates worry that without limits on how much data can be gathered or how long it can be stored, law enforcement could use the technology to build databases that track the behavior and movement of people who are not part of criminal investigations. Well, of course they could, and they could also just create those criminal investigations around them, right?
Mm-hmm.
Authorities, though, have argued on the other side that cell phone tracking can be useful. Homeland Security Assistant Secretary Seth Stauder testified before a congressional committee last year that Stingray technology, there it is, led authorities to a six-year-old girl who had been kidnapped in Arizona. All right. This coming Wednesday on Big Al's show, Big Al Kurtz, Community Chat is the name of his show. That's Wednesday, July 27th at 8 p.m. They are going to have Marcus Jackson on. He's an award-winning Illinois men's basketball beat writer for the News Gazette. According to Al, he covers breaking news and does game coverage and feature writing, multimedia responsibilities, including online chats, video reports, radio hosting, and television appearances, editing, page designing, headline writing, and he has developed a social media presence with 7,000 Twitter followers. I think it'll be the opposite of the discussion we're going to be having today.
Yeah, I have a feeling we're going to be a little more political.
Yeah, probably so. Let's see. What else do I want to tell you about? I wanted to let you know that if you have an old clunker of a car, you can donate it to WEFT. It's super fast and easy. They pick up the car, whether it's running or not. They handle all the paperwork. You get a tax receipt, and WEFT gets the money. So if you have an old clunker that you have need to get rid of, we would love to have it as a donation. 877-411-3662. Even if it's not an old clunker, they will sell it for you and give us the donation for that. So that's really great. And wanted to let you also know about Makerspace, which is in the basement of the Urbana-Champaign Independent Media Center as well. But you know what? This is different. This is makerlab.illinois.edu. So I have a little different information here. makerlab.illinois.edu. It's have volunteers help with various aspects of lab operations, workshops, and more. Don't know about that. And one more announcement, then we're going to get to our topic. And that is that there is a mental health and recovery group called GROW, in Illinois, and it's partnering with an organization called Over the Edge to help support Grow, which is a really worthwhile organization. They're going to have it's going to be taking place Saturday, August 20th at Eden Supportive Living Building, located at 222 North State Street in Champaign, and it gives you a chance to rappel 8 stories down the Eden Supportive Living Building in downtown Champaign to raise awareness for mental health and recovery. There's only a few spots, and you have to have a team, I think, to do it, or at least a couple of people. And if you want to register so that you can rappel down the side of a building and join me, because I think I'm going to do it. I think it sounds kind of exciting. So it's across from Westside Park, and it's growinamerica.org/overtheedge, all with dashes in between. So growinamerica.org, that's all one word, and then over-the-edge-2016. Or you can call me after the show, and I'll give you the information. Or email weft90.1@gmail.com, where I can give you information on any of the stuff that I just talked about. All right, now to get to our topic of the evening, which is about the Olympics in Rio. First of all, Neil, welcome to the show.
Thank you very much for having me on. I really appreciate it.
Glad to have you here. I wonder if we're not hearing you. Sorry. Oh, that's so bad. I didn't have my mics on. Okay, we'll try that again.
Thank you very much for having me here. I really appreciate it.
All right. So you were missing some of what Neil said about when I was talking to him, and he was explaining about the surveillance through the cell phones too, but hopefully you caught enough of that. We were able to hear it. Okay, picked up on my mic. All right, so I thought I would just start by telling people that you are a contributor to the Public Eye, which is one of our partners, and show people what the Public Eye looks like. It's a newspaper that you can see, pick up all around town. And Public Eye has been in existence for, 12, 15 years, something like that. I was one of the founding editors of it, and lots of people have contributed over the year, but they got a good solid bunch of contributors now, of which you are one. You contribute regularly, don't you?
Usually, yeah.
Yeah.
When my schedule allows me to.
Yes, yes. Well, there's lots of good political commentary on it, some of it local, some of it national, and some of it worldwide. And you like to bring a little of both, and you are usually commentating on the same thing you do your show on, which is the intersection of sports and politics. So tell me about, let's start with the politics of Rio. And tell me what you know about how Rio is governed. First of all, it's a democracy, correct?
Correct.
And who is the current president?
Well, right now, there has been pretty much a coup, as a lot of activists on the ground are calling it, that Dilma Rousseff, who was very, very unpopular, there was a scandal involving their very nationalized oil industry, Petrobras, and due to that scandal and a whole bunch of kickbacks to a number of prominent politicians, she was removed from office, and they have a interim president, Michelle Temer, who has been put in place. He's also been found to have been involved in this corruption, so he can't run for president next time, but he is still allowed to maintain his job in Rio. Mm-hmm. And the politics of Rio, when they got the games for the Olympics in 2016, when that was announced, and when they got the 2014 World Cup, both those announcements came at a time that they're economies were booming. Mm-hmm. It was late 2009, and the economies were, in very high accord. They were hitting record growth rates, and that was also a time that you had a lot of the oil bubble. And so their economies were booming. There was a lot of success there, and so they saw that giving the ability to host these kinds of events, like the FIFA World Cup in 2014 and hosting the Olympics in 2016... were going to be putting them on the world stage, that they were going to become one of the major countries, they were going to be one of the top economies, and that this was going to get them a lot of international attention. However, since they've gotten awarded these games, a recession has hit, and the government is facing some very real problems of funding all of these priorities, that there had been a lot of concern about the cost of these stadiums even before the recession hit, and the recession simply compounded that.
The recession and the instability of the government, I guess, right?
Yes.
Instability.
And they've had Olympic cost overruns. You know, this is something that we see in Rio. Oxford University just put their current estimate at the cost overruns being 51%.
Right now, for Rio's 2016 Olympics, for the projection or already?
From their original projections that the organizers had claimed, they're already overrunning that cost by 51%.
Okay. But that's not atypical of Olympics, is it?
No, that is not atypical of Olympics. It's not really an outlier. You've seen that in a number of different instances. The average overrun, according to the major program management school at Oxford Business, is 179%.
Mm-hmm.
And probably the most famous one was the 1976 Montreal Games, which finally paid off their debt in 2006.
So can you tell me who they pay off that debt to? Who are they indebted to?
A lot of times it's simply paying off the stadiums that they've had to build. And in a lot of cities, when the private corporate interests, the corporate sponsors don't come through, the taxpayers are on the hook for all of the cost overruns.
Mm-hmm.
And so it becomes building these facilities and then the taxpayers being the ones who are on the hook to paying for these facilities.
Is the general idea that the Olympics should pay for themselves? At one time, maybe they did before all these cost overruns, before it became such like the major extravaganza that it is, that they would somehow pay for itself by the tourism?
There was hopes, and a lot of times when you see organizers talking about this, they always talk about the tourism boost, they always talk about people coming in, and you see that very, very briefly, but a lot of those times it's simply money that was going to be spent that's simply getting diverted to Rio as a one-time cost, and it's not more money coming into Rio. You're not getting more tourists plus the tourists you were already expecting. You're simply getting a chunk of money coming in.
Mm-hmm.
And when a lot of the games, especially since 1968, some estimates put it far back as 1960, have had cost overruns, it's been the public who's been stuck at the helm of having to carry all these cost overruns on, while the IOC, to quote Jules Boykoff, a Olympic historian, flies off in their golden helicopters.
Mm-hmm. Well, where does the money from the Olympics come from at all? So where is the funds generated from?
A lot of it has become corporate relationships.
Uh-huh.
That in recent years, one of the things that the International Olympic Committee has identified as a problem is what they call gigantism, which is essentially that the Olympics are becoming too big of an extravaganza, and that there's too many corporate relationships, and there's too many corporate sponsors, and they're having to pull in all of this money from corporate sponsors and corporate relationships, Coca-Cola, GE, numerous different companies, McDonald's, all being official sponsors. And with that comes some very real branding and laws that are on the books to really protect branding. And we're seeing that in Rio right now, that they've passed a anti-terrorism law, which is very vaguely written to allow for activists to be considered terrorists if they're involved in activist protest and activist activity because of how vaguely this bill is worded. And that's something that we've seen happen in numerous host cities when it comes to issues of policing there. Going back to the 1984 games, the old anti-union, anti-syndicalist laws got used in LA to try to wipe people off the streets in advance of the 84 games. But after 9/11, the security complexes really started to pick up, and we started to see more protection of these kind of corporate naming rights. That in London, they actually had a law on the books that said you couldn't use certain words like 2012 Olympics gold, silver, bronze, and London Games. And a certain amount of these words would be the critical mass where they would come in and go after you. In Vancouver in 2010.
Now, let's slow down a minute, man. You got a lot of information there. Okay, so we were talking about how the Olympics were funded. We're talking about corporate sponsorship. And then we're moving over to non-terrorism and putting a kibosh on activists.
Well, a lot of it comes to the kibosh on activists to protect the brands.
Uh-huh.
Because in 2010, there was a law put on the books in Vancouver that said you could only have signs that were praising the Olympics. And if you even had it up in your home, it authorized authorities to potentially go into your house and take down the sign.
Hmm.
That if you had a sign that was making fun of the Olympics or undermining a corporate brand, they could come in and remove that sign.
Hmm.
And we saw that in 2012 with the London Games, as there was protests going on about some of the corporate greenwashing and going after some of the corporate sponsors of the Olympics, that people were arrested for their protest actions simply highlighting these facts.
So if somebody wanted to, say McDonald's as a sponsor, and they wanted to take the opportunity then to protest about the inhumane treatment of animals from McDonald's or whatever, or exploiting workers, there are laws on the books that are specific to the Olympics, in many times passed by the cities, in order to not have that happen. Is that what we're hearing?
Yeah, the IOC actually demands that host cities put certain laws on the books to protect their corporate sponsors, because they want these corporate sponsors to get something out of the massive corporate donations that they're giving to them.
Mm-hmm.
And so they take very, very seriously protecting a lot of these brands.
Hmm. So you have your corporate sponsorships. They are advertising, like, is it the McDonald's Stadium or the naming rights? Or is it
that, you know, McDonald's might be the official fast food, or Coca-Cola is the official drink of the Olympics. Mm-hmm. But when you look at Michael Phelps or the U.S. Women's National Soccer Team, they're not eating McDonald's. They're not drinking a lot of Coca-Cola.
Let's hope not. And then, of course, who's broadcasting the Olympics this year?
The NBC, they have a massive television rights deal to put the Olympics on, and a lot of people are going to be tuning in. That's what they're expecting. Rio's expecting that, to have all the eyes of the world on them. And what's happening in Rio is what we're seeing a lot of in the U.S. press and English-speaking press primarily is, are the stadiums going to be ready? And the Zika virus. But in talking with people who have stayed in Rio or are in Rio currently, a few weeks ago on the show, we had an interview with Jules Boykoff. This week, coming up on Saturday, we've got an interview with Teresa Williamson, who is working for a Rio-based collective working with favelas. And they're just like, yeah, Zika's not that big of an issue for us right now. It's August, so it's winter. It's going to be a low mosquito season. It's not one of the major things that we're worried about.
Tell us what a favela is.
Favelas are the communities that are in Rio. Usually in the States, a lot of English-speaking press tends to use the word slum, or we tend to think of the 2002 movie City of God and the rampant crime that's there. But favelas are really unique pieces of the community. They started out going back to the 1800s, building the, you know, kind of shanty towns, but as they've gotten more and more investment and more time being spent there, the overwhelming amount of homes don't fit the definitions of ghetto or slum, that almost all of them have brick and cement housing, they have running water, they have electricity, they do have limited internet access, given the fact that Wi-Fi and internet access in all of Brazil is still an issue. And about 65% of the residents there are considered middle class. And most importantly, most of these favelas have the legal right to remain there, and have had that legal right to remain there.
Are they private property?
Yeah, it's essentially private communities.
Uh-huh.
And they have a legal right to be there, but as we've seen with the Rio Olympics coming in, that hasn't necessarily stopped the government from trying to force them out.
Uh-huh. So it's substandard housing by some people's definition, by other people's, hey, it's housing. I got a place to live. I have a roof over my head.
Well, even to give one of the oldest favelas, it's almost all brick or reinforced steel or concrete housing that we'd consider over half of them to be in middle-class houses, that almost all of them are made out of brick, all of them are made out of concrete, or have tiled reinforced roofs, that they're kind of the do-it-yourself communities.
Uh-huh.
And most of the people have wanted to stay there, and we've seen favelas being evicted. Current estimates put it about 77,000 people between 2009 and 2015 have been evicted to build the games.
Wow, say that again. How many?
About 77,000, according to current estimates.
Well, where are they?
They have been displaced throughout Rio. Some people have been given housing that is very close to where they used to live. Some people have been displaced up to 25 miles away from where they used to live. And you can see that really well in the article I wrote. One of the favelas, Vila Autodromo, which was put kind of kitty corner right next to where they wanted to build the Olympic Village.
Well, let me just read it here, what you have to say about it. So many residents believe that the games are a vehicle for real estate developers to get land that can be used after the games as high-priced housing. The story of Villa Autodromo Favela ties all these issues together closely. Villa Autodromo?
Yes. Yeah.
Villa Autodromo has been long-standing thriving favela community with legal rights to its land since the 1990s. Despite having ownership title and multiple court rulings affirming the community's ability to stay, Mayor Eduardo Pace announced in 2009, right after the Rio won the 2016 bid, that there would be imminent evictions of the community because it buttressed the land proposed for the Olympic Park. The favela residents had worked with city planners to develop a workable solution that showed how the proposed Olympics facility and community could easily coexist. After court battles to stop possible eviction, they had reached an agreement with Mayor Pace in 2013 that they'd been able to stay in their homes if they desired. However, many residents noted that there had been significant pressure from the government to get them to leave Villa Autodromo.
Yeah, some of that pressure included, you know, turning off water, giving them intermittent access to electricity, putting up walls in certain parts of the community saying that the Olympic Park was under construction, and if you wanted to get to the other part of your town, you would have to get a special ID badge and go through a whole rigmarole to get through going, you know, through your own town if you're taking a walk or going on any kind of visit. So it wasn't necessarily Mayor Pais who was doing that, but it was all of his underlings who were enforcing that policy so he could say, well, I've never forced them to leave, which is technically true. It was just a lot of the offices beneath him that was enforcing that kind of policy.
Residents who ultimately chose to move were not appropriately compensated by the government. And as of this writing, approximately 90% of the Villa Autodromo Favela had been evicted to build the Olympic Park facilities. After the games conclude, the Olympic Park will become a luxury apartment complex called Pure Island, Isla Pura, meant to be, as a real estate developer Carlos Carvalho called it, a city of the elites.
Yes. It's not going to be a geographic island, but it's certainly going to be an economic island of very, you know, high-priced luxury condominiums and luxury apartments. And the residents of Villa Autodromo, because they really pushed a lot of their protest, they really were involved in a lot of their protest, they were able to mostly stay within a mile of where they were when they got relocated, and the city ended up having to give them a lot more compensation than they would have otherwise given. And you don't see that in some of the other favelas where they got moved up as far as 25 miles away. And so some of these residents are having difficulty getting transportation to their jobs, or being moved into communities where the cost of living is higher, or as a reality, especially in some zones of Rio, there's privatized militias that basically run the community, which are often off-duty or retired firemen, police, or military, that ask for protection money from the residents to keep out drugs or to keep out undesirables. And if you don't pay them, then you face the wrath of these militias.
Mm-hmm. All right. It is 6:31. You are listening to WEFT Champaign 90.1 FM, streaming online at weft.org. The views and opinions expressed on air are solely those of the speakers and do not necessarily represent those of WEFT Champaign, Prairie Air Incorporated, Station Management Board of Directors, or the Associates. Neither do they represent those of UPTV or anywhere else that this is played. They're solely the views and opinions of Neil and I. Neil Partham is my guest. He is the host of Not Just Another Sports Show, which airs on WRFU and is produced in the studios of WRFU in UCIMC, the Urbana-Champaign Independent Media Center in downtown Urbana at the in the old post office building. There's a lot going on at the IMC. It's one of our definitely more progressive spaces in town where you can be involved with a lot of different organizations, including Books to Prisoners, Black Lives Matters, Makerspace, and more. And you're involved with WRFU for how long now?
Since 2011.
Mm-hmm. And what inspires you to have the show, or what is your how do you get so involved with sports and come at it from this unique perspective that you do?
Well, I think sports is inherently kind of a political space, and for as much as I love Noam Chomsky, I really loathe the statement that he had made of talking about sports diverts people's attention from things that matter.
Mm-hmm.
And I hardly disagree. Sports do matter. Sports are inherently a political space. They're a reflection of the society in which we live. For instance, if we're going to talk about the smashing of Jim Crow in the United States, you mentioned Jackie Robinson and that story. If you're going to talk about the resistance to the Vietnam War, you mentioned the story of Muhammad Ali.
Mm-hmm.
And as we sit in a space currently before the show, we're talking about the WNBA and how a number of players were wearing Black Lives Matter shirts or wearing black shirts to protest. Or Carmelo Anthony coming out publicly and on ESPN saying, quote, the system is broken, close
mm-hmm.
quote.
Mm-hmm.
We're seeing this kind of intersection of sports and politics.
Come over this with this way. There you go. Thanks. Okay, so we're seeing the intersection of sports and policy in all of those cases.
Yeah, and you know, we're seeing that happening with the funding of stadiums and the prioritization of funding stadiums over social services. You know, going back to Rio, that a lot of the housing issues there, people were upset even before they got the games. And that the fact that they were going to prioritize funding these massive stadiums or these massive, you know, infrastructure deals or to privatize more land into the hands of real estate developers was something that was already offensive to them, given the number of issues that they wanted to get addressed, like the massive pollution in some of the rivers and waterways that they wanted to see addressed. And that's been something that had been promised to be addressed since the 1990s. And the Olympic organizers in Rio very rightly said, oh, we're going to clean up Guanabara Bay. We're going to clean up 80% of the pollution. And they publicly put this out there for people to see. And then very quietly said, well, no, we're not. And then even quieter said, oh, we never came up with a way to have those numbers in the first place. We just kind of picked that number out of a hat and threw it out there for people to all say, oh, yeah, that's a thing. And in talking with Teresa Williamson, she was mentioning the fact that there's a phrase in Brazil called for the English to see. And she's like, yeah, we all knew in Rio that that wasn't going to happen. We all knew that wasn't going to happen, but it was put out there for the English to see. So we could all feel good. And, oh, yeah, that was a thing.
Mm-hmm.
Which goes back,
and was she referring to just English speakers?
Yes.
Uh-huh. So,
and it goes back to Great Britain and the legacy of slavery, which is something that Brazil really hasn't ever dealt with. Brazil was one of the largest importers of slaves during the slave trade. Emory University says that they believe between 4 and 5 million slaves were brought into Brazil, compared to the U.S. mainland over that same time, 389,000.
Hmm.
And Rio probably estimated amounts at 21.5% of all slaves came into Rio, and Rio was the city that imported the most slaves in the Americas.
Hmm.
And here in the States, we've had a civil rights movement. We've had that kind of reckoning about the really overt racial discrimination. Brazil hasn't ever seen that. Going back to 1827, English had abolished the international slave trade and was pressuring Portugal to do the exact same thing. At this time, Brazil was still a colonial holding of Portugal. And in 1827, Portugal said, oh, we'll sign this treaty. Yeah, we're going to cut down the slave trade. Well, in the 3 years after that treaty was signed, the slave trade skyrocketed.
Hmm.
It was simply put out there for the English to see.
Mm-hmm.
In 1831, they said that every slave that was coming in would automatically be freed. Well, that was just for the English to see, and it was never actually enforced.
Take a quick musical interlude, and then we're going to come right back and talk more to Neil Partham.
Thank you.
Welcome back to CU Progressive News. You're getting a little history lesson here on Brazil and a lot of things to do with Brazil. It's really, I'm finding it fascinating. So let's just continue. So we're talking about the fact that there's whitewashing for the English, basically.
Yeah, this was essentially all stuff for the English to see. And I mean, slavery wasn't abolished in Brazil until 1888. And yet, 60 years beforehand, they're signing on to legislation saying, oh, yeah, we'll ban slavery. Oh, yeah, we'll get rid of slavery. Mm-hmm. Those things were simply for the English to see. Mm-hmm. And we're seeing that kind of stuff happening here with the Olympics in 2016.
Right. So you were talking about the environmental issues. So they said they were going to clean up the bay.
And, yeah, they made up the numbers, and they never had a plan to do that. And that goes back to promises from the 1990s. And they've now said, well, we're not actually going to clean up that bay.
Yeah, so they've not even made any attempt whatsoever.
Yeah, there's been very minimal attempts to get the bays cleaned. And it's also become a concern for some of the water sport athletes who are going to have to compete in rivers that are dangerous. But outside of the Olympics, there's a lot of fishermen who are very concerned about the mass deaths of fish that are happening. And it's really inhibiting their ability to have a day job and to pull in money. And they're the ones who are going to have to be dealing with the pollution of the bay. The residents who use it for water sources are going to be the ones who are going to have to deal with it.
Do you feel like there's going to be more pollution due to the Olympics?
Well, a lot of the greenwashing of the Rio Games has been a part of it becomes part and parcel of the recent games that they tend to greenwash. We're going to see that with the original pledge of trees, even.
Right. So you write that in preparation for the Games, Rio 2016 organizers pledged that they would plant 24 million trees, a way to offset the pollution. By September 2014, they announced they would now plant 34 million trees, as well as take on significant efforts to clean some polluted waterways and lagoons. However, the authorities balked and said this would not be completed for the Games. The Olympics also require that host cities build a number of new facilities. This one has me a little miffed here. With the inclusion of golf as an Olympic event, the government has partially turned a protected nature reserve into a golf course. The reserve space has been bisected, and the government approved this via a special law. The ruling allowed the golf course to be approved without doing any environmental impact studies or management programs, no public hearings allowed for general input. At the conclusion of the Olympics, the land will become the site of privately owned luxury condominiums and apartments.
Which fits the narrative that a lot of residents have had, which is that a lot of this public land is going to be privatized for private wealth development. And we're talking about the Merapendi Protected Nature Reserve, and this golf course kind of bisects that nature reserve now. And estimates of the golf course have said a $4 to $5 million golf course is hitting the high end. They spent an estimated $27 million building this golf course and this nature reserve.
Hmm.
If $4 to $5 million is the high end, spending $27 million to build this golf course.
What? Yeah. Obviously, they're building it for the after effect of the development.
And Rio already had two golf courses that could have been repurposed to meet the needs of the Games. They chose to use this kind of opportunity, which mm-hmm. a lot of states do, is to use these kinds of opportunities to move on things they wouldn't normally get to do otherwise.
Right, right. To take away from the public wealth and put it in the hands of private. Mm-hmm.
I mean, but you know, the environmental issue is also not just a Rio only event or, oh, Rio's having all of these problems. I mean, you can go back to the 1990s where the IOC started pledging that they were going to deal with sustainability. And that's always been a very fungible term to them.
Okay, so we want to talk about policing yet, and then we want to talk about the overall picture of has the Olympics got too big for its own good, right?
Yes.
Okay, so policing in the Games. Despite threats of strikes by the police and state security forces in Rio, there's set to be an estimated 85,000 police present for the Olympics, more than double the security at the 2012 London Olympics. The massive surge in police presence in advance of Games is deeply concerning to human rights advocates. I guess so. 85,000 police in one city. That's a lot of...
Well, it even connects back to earlier when we were talking about the legacy of slavery that's never really been addressed. That those kinds of attitudes, those kinds of ideas are still incredibly pervasive in these police departments. And here in the States, at least, we've gotten rid of some of the more overt versions of institutionalized white supremacy. And we haven't seen that happen necessarily in Brazil, that there's been a trend of police killings going back to 2014 that's on the steady increase from 2014 into 2015 and into 2016. And most of the victims of police violence being black men from the favelas.
Gotcha.
And as Amnesty International notes, from 2011 to 2015, 219 cases of incidences where no officer has been charged. 219 out of 220, no officer has been charged.
219 killings by police from what years?
2011 to 2015.
Mm-hmm.
Amnesty International also...
And with an upswing in 2014 and 15, I see that you reported.
Yes, and they're even seeing now, as new reports are coming out in advance of the games, that there's an uptick again of police being more trigger happy.
Yeah. And because they're probably just in more conflict just because of the, if their people are being displaced and, you know, more activity going on in the city, there's bound to be more.
Between 2008 and 2013, even in advance of getting the cup, they killed the same amount of people that the American police did in those 5 years, 2008 to 2013. They killed the same amount of people that the American police killed in 30 years.
The specifically Rio did, or Brazil and all of Brazil, do you know?
I believe it's in Rio that they had such a... And they have 50% fewer people.
That's kind of bad.
It's become a very concerning issue of police violence that Human Rights Watch noted in 2015 that three quarters of the people being killed by police are black men from the favelas. And so right now we're seeing Black Lives Matter protesters getting ready to go down to Brazil to highlight some of these issues. And the 85,000 police and security actors, certainly we're seeing, you know, the threats of strikes or the police holding up the signs that say, welcome to hell, you're not going to be safe. You know, the tourists will be safe. The tourists will be fine. Brazil throws its parties and does it well.
Have you been there?
I have not been talking with people who have. Uh-huh. The Americans and tourists have nothing to worry about.
Yeah.
You're not going to be the ones that are targeted by the police.
Uh-huh.
But the police are now even saying that they're going to occupy some of the favelas for the duration of the games to pacify them. And we're seeing a lot of new technologies, a lot of new police weapons, new cameras, you know, new information technology.
I imagine they're militarized there.
Yes. Mm-hmm. Being brought in. And those things don't go away once the games are over.
No, they don't
take down the closed-circuit cameras. And with that new anti-terrorism law that's on the books, conflating protesting and terrorism, that's something we've seen with the IOC as well, that we're in the aftermath of 9/11, we're seeing an increasing policing and militarization shift and kind of intermelding with one another, that the military is becoming part of the police. In advance of the Athens Games in Greece, the SAIC, that private security company, set up a surveillance center to monitor data to come in. And it previously had only been used by the United States military, and it was given over to the Hellenic police to use in advance of the games. They added new closed-circuit cameras, helicopters, surveillance vans. Those things didn't go away after Greece hosted. In Beijing, they put up $6 billion in closed-circuit cameras in advance of the games.
Okay, wait a minute. $6 billion in closed circuit cameras.
They had 600,000 volunteers out on the streets to snitch on people for suspicious behavior.
Uh-huh. Oh, the state of the world.
I mean, we even see the issue in London. They got the long-range acoustic device, which was previously a military weapon, which was used in Iraq, which puts on a deafening, high decibel, very painful noise to try to control and disperse a crowd.
Yes.
And they were having that on the streets of London. Vancouver had an MRAD, a medium version of that, on the streets in London. Or on the streets of Vancouver, excuse mm-hmm. me. And in Russia, we saw massive security states being built there, and the kind of flow of military technology into these policing forces that doesn't just go away after the games are hosted.
Do you think that, I guess the games give it give it some credence to be able to do it. It seems like it's happening anyway. It's happening everywhere. It's happening here where we militarize our police. But certainly then you think it's just an escalation that happens around the games. And did it happen around like the World Cup and different events like that as well?
Yeah, a lot of times with mega events, you do see this kind of ability for governments and state actors to get away with things they wouldn't necessarily be mm-hmm. able to get away mm-hmm. with.
And so the taking of the land, the and the militarization and the treatment of the residents, specifically the poor, usually.
Yeah, mm-hmm. it's from policing to the environment, housing issues, dealing with labor rights and the abilities to kind of curb labor laws.
Mm-hmm.
You see that tending to happen a lot when these kind of mega events come to town.
Well, let's talk about, so your closing argument here in the paper, we won't call it an argument, your closing paragraphs. British Olympic fencer Lawrence Halstead recently wrote in The Guardian, "I have been forced to grapple with the fact that the Olympics come with a negative side effect for the host nation. Silence in the face of such injustice could be wrongly interpreted as implicit approval." He continued, "The current model of staging increasingly extravagant Olympics is unsustainable and cannot, in all good conscience, continue. There is much that can be done. As a society, we need to every voice we can to pitch in on the social and environmental issues that are threatening our future. And it's time for athletes to embrace this new paradigm and start speaking up without fear of derision." While refreshing, you say, to hear another athlete use his platform to speak out, Halstead does raise a present point that we can have entertaining sporting events with amazing athletic displays without the damaging and devastating effects on host cities, and that this is all on all of us to embrace the new paradigm to make it a reality. Any movements toward that? Is there anything going on social justice wise?
Well, there have been activist athletes going back even to the early 1900s. Was recently reading in preparation for an interview with Jules Boykoff his book Power Games, A Political History of the Olympics, which is a very fantastic read of the Olympics from its early inception all the way up through Rio and kind of the political history, that there were political athletes in the very early 1900s, a Irish athlete, for instance, who had to compete under the British flag and was very mad about that. And when he won a track event, he shimmied up the flagpole with an Erin Go Brath flag instead. And his teammate on the ground was fending off the police and stuff who were trying to get him down. The most famous one being Tommy Smith and John Carlos and Peter Norman in 1968, that image that's been on most college students' dorm room walls.
Mm-hmm.
And you had the Olympic Project for Human Rights, and you may not notice that Peter Norman, the guy who got second place, is wearing an Olympic Project for Human Rights button, and he was totally with them in what they did, and he faced repercussions too. I mean, not as much as Smith and Carlos, who ended up having their wife commit suicide because of all the pressure. And when he got back to Australia, even though he qualified for the Olympics, he was never allowed to go back. And the three of them had been lifelong friends. And when he ended up dying, Smith and Carlos were actually pallbearers at his funeral. I mean, we've seen athletes in the 80s using their platforms. We've seen athletes in the 90s using their platforms. We've had athletes, especially.
But it seems like they've been using their platforms not about the Olympics, but about other human rights violations that are taking place. So they get the spotlight and they use it then.
Yeah, I mean, we've seen snowboarding athletes highlighting global climate change being uh-huh. an issue of, if we don't address this, this is destroying my sport.
Yeah.
And highlighting that being a very real problem. And we've had Aboriginal athletes from Australia wearing an Aboriginal flag and getting kind of, you know, a little smackdown for that of, that's not an appropriate thing. We're not supposed to politicize the Olympics, but the Olympics are inherently political in taking taxpayer money and having these kinds of effects on host cities. They're inherently political entities. And there's a lot of activism that's been going on in host cities in prior to the games even taking place there. In Chicago, there was a vibrant activist community of, no, we don't want the games here. And when Chicago ultimately didn't get the 2016 games,
they bid on them?
Yes, mm-hmm. they had bid. In fact, they're still paying off $91 million on a building they thought was going to be the Olympic Village that they can't sell off now.
Really? Where's that at? Do you know?
Oh, it's in
downtown. They built it before they got the bid?
Oh, they bought the rights to a building that they wanted to knock down
uh-huh.
in advance of the games. And when they didn't get them, thanks to a lot of activism and traveling, like talking to the International Olympic Committee, residents from Chicago went over and started talking to the IOC of, this is a bad idea for all of these reasons, highlighting, you know, a number of issues in Chicago.
Yes.
Mm-hmm. We've seen the same thing recently with Boston, that they had a activist mobilization effort to keep the games out of Boston. Some very funny ones of interviewing residents of Boston and saying, would you like a velodrome? Or would you like affordable housing?
Uh-huh.
And a bunch of people being, what's a velodrome?
What is a velodrome?
It's for biking, Olympic biking. And so what we're seeing is, you know, states like Oslo voted to pull their Olympic bid for 2022. And the only two countries that were bidding for 2022 were two very autocratic and authoritarian states, Almaty, Kazakhstan, and Beijing, China. And China getting the nod for 2022. That the Olympics are very much on their back foot, that athletes are speaking out, activists are very heavily involved in their communities speaking out. In London, there was some really amusing activism that was taking place where they gave out the gold, silver, and bronze medals for greenwashing of corporate sponsors of the Olympics. There had been some very, very powerful activism taking place in Vancouver, really creative stuff. In London, they did some mock Shakespearean theater of highlighting some of these issues where they had a BP logo and they kept yelling, out, damn spot, out. But we're seeing the Olympics really being on their back foot here and recognizing that they're going to have to address the gigantism issues, to use their words, or the effects on these host cities, because host cities don't want to host.
Right. Hmm. And then when is the next Olympics after 2016? So who's hosting that?
Oh, we will be going 2020, I believe, is Tokyo, Japan, which has already started having issues of evictions. A homeless park, Meiji Park, has already started to see the police moving in and evicting the homeless communities out of Meiji Park.
Wow. Well, it's been a pleasure to have you here today, Neil. Thank you.
Thank you very much for having me.
Yeah, wow, you are a wealth of information. I would love to have you on another time so we could talk about football. I'm not a football fan and have a lot to think about with regard to the helmets and the brain injuries, and I bet you have a lot to say about that.
Oh, Roger Goodell is quickly, very, very quickly in the running for worst commissioner in the history of ever. Because it's very interesting. His father was actually one of the congressmen who helped bring Nixon down in Watergate.
Hmm.
And now he's being brought down by audio tapes and videotapes and all sorts of other damning evidence.
If you're interested in hearing more from Neil, he has his own show, not just another sports show, on WRFU, which is a low-powered FM station, 104.5. You can get it if you're in Urbana, or he also, like we do, record our show for UPTV. And tell us again when you're played on UPTV. Is it 6 p.m.?
I believe it is in Wednesday evening. It's also available iTunes and Stitcher and other
podcasts. Oh, yeah. So you have your own podcast?
Yes.
Oh, good. And it's called that?
Yeah, Not Another Sports Show. Yeah.
Not Another Sports Show. So good on the podcast. Good to know. And also, he's on UPTV's YouTube channel, I believe, correct? Yeah. So lots of places you can catch his show, and always interesting conversations. Tell us about some of your upcoming shows.
This Saturday, we have Teresa Williamson on, talking about the current state of affairs in Rio from someone who's on the ground working with the favelas and some of the effects, and how what happens in Rio isn't necessarily a Rio-centric thing like we might all like to think it is. Mm-hmm. It's something that comes part and parcel with hosting these kinds of mega events.
Very interesting. Thank you. Thank you for being on. Thanks for our listeners for listening and tuning in. I want to let you know that you have been listening to CU Progressive News, bringing you the many voices of your community. This show is produced live in the studios of WEFT 90.1 FM at 113 North Market Street in downtown Champaign. It's a collaborative effort, and you can be trained to be a citizen reporter or to be a WEFT host of this show or any music show or any show that you would like to propose. The CU Progressive Calendar is a sister project, and it's available at tinyurl.com/CU Progressive. We're indebted to WEFT and its members, who have for 35 years provided the infrastructure for independent media. We're indebted to the Public Eye, UCIMC, UPTV, and all else for their collaborative efforts. The views and opinions expressed on the air were solely those of the speakers and do not necessarily represent those of WEFT Champaign, Prairie Air, Station Management, Board of Directors, Associates, or anyone else. And we are going to go out with some music off of Kevin Elliott's CD, Patterns of Blue. We're going to hear Been Running Too Long.
Time is up now, I've been running too long. This feeling is way too strong. Why is it always gotta be so sad? Hate to say it, hardest trouble I ever had. Been too long now, you worry me. You're somewhere out on a mission, wishing you were here in bed, instead of racing round inside my head. Hate to say it, hard trouble, like I said. And I love you, I can't get through when you're out on the street in your walking shoes. Waste of time, that's a crime, ought to be a law. Could be dropping a dime instead of meeting up now. We're beating up now, what a pisser, riding the kisser. Time is up now, I've been running too long. Now what did I do wrong? Why's it always gotta hurt so bad? Hate to say it, hardest loving I ever had. And I love you, at least I think I do. You hear what I'm saying, you think so too. You might as well, what the hell? Tell me you love me, you never can tell.
It's 7 o'clock and you're tuned to WEFT Champaign 90.1 FM. Time now for Champaign-Urbana Radio Theater. We'll start off with two episodes back